loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. First, we go over the Paul Manafort verdict that came in yesterday, and Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, his plea deal. We talk about what the mainstream media is covering, how they're covering it, what they're saying, and how it actually impacts on the allegations of Russia collusion. We'll talk through some of the coverage we've seen in the mainstream corporate-owned media. And then it's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment every Wednesday called Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. Today, we'll dive into Donald Trump's broader energy proposal that would strip out coal regulations. How are coal and nuclear issues similar? How are they related?
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Facebook announced yesterday that it had taken down 652 fake accounts and pages with ties to Iranian and Russian propaganda organs. The company said there were four different campaigns, with three originating in Iran. Is Facebook jumping on the war hysteria bandwagon? Next, Saudi Arabia is preparing to execute five people, including a woman, for participating in peaceful demonstrations in support of rights for Shia Muslims. The public prosecutor, who reports directly to King Salman, has charged the five with a variety of so-called crimes, including participating in protests, incitement to protest, chanting slogans, attempting to inflame public opinion, filming protests, and providing moral support to rioters. The five could be beheaded as soon as Friday. Then, Russia's foreign minister said that the Taliban have accepted an invitation to attend talks on the future of Afghanistan to be held in Moscow on September 4th. Sergei Lavrov said that the aim of the talks is to encourage the Taliban to abandon hostilities, to engage in a dialogue with the Afghan government, and to protect Russian citizens in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, hopes for a temporary halt in the fighting have broken down following a mass kidnapping and a rocket attack on the presidential palace as President Ashraf Ghani was giving a speech. And then National Security Advisor John Bolton said yesterday that the United States would respond, quote, very strongly, unquote, if forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad use chemical weapons in an offensive to retake Idlib province. But doesn't that just open the door for U.S. allied forces to use chemical weapons and then blame the Syrian government? And finally, tensions between the United States and Turkey, along with the country's economic instability, continue to heat up. Bolton told reporters yesterday that Turkey could end its lira battering crisis with Washington instantly by freeing a detained American pastor. Bolton added that promises of cash from the Qatari government will not save Turkey's economy. And in other headlines, Mexico's economy minister said today that the remaining discussions on the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, between the U.S. and Mexico should be cleared up today or in the next several days. President-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador's chief negotiator made similar comments. Canada is waiting to rejoin negotiations until the U.S. and Mexico have settled their primary discussions. Saudi Arabia has announced that it will not go forward with the highly anticipated initial public offering of stock in the country's Aramco oil company. While the IPO would have only involved selling a 5% stake in the company, because of the huge value of Saudi oil reserves, that fraction of Aramco was expected to be valued in the tens of billions of dollars. The cancellation of the IPO appears to be a major blow to the economic development plan led by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. UN political chief Rosemary DiCarlo announced today that the UN has run out of funding to pay for fuel for hospitals and other vital resources in the Gaza Strip. She has also said that over 40% of drug stocks are completely gone. She is requesting $4.5 million to run basic services for the rest of 2018. John Cornyn, the second-ranking Republican in the Senate, announced today that he expected a delay before the Senate takes up a sentencing reform bill aimed at reducing some of the most extreme practices related to incarceration. Cornyn said, quote, I think the sentencing reforms are still controversial and divide Republicans. I just don't see the wisdom of dividing Republicans on a contentious matter like that before the election, unquote. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
loud and clear.
Now we turn to the guilty verdict of Paul Manafort, the plea deal with Michael Cohen, what it means for so-called Russiagate, what it means for the Trump administration 24 hours later. We're joined from New York City by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. His most recent piece is Fighting Fake Stories, The New Yorker, Israel, and Obama. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of the book The Plot to Attack Iran, amongst other books. And we're joined from Virginia by Joe Loria. He is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he is the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Joe Loria, we had you yesterday, early in the day, earlier in the afternoon, before the jury came in on the Manafort verdict. He was found guilty on 8 out of 18 counts. Then Michael Cohen pled guilty. Then his lawyer, Lanny Davis, who was, of course, Bill Clinton's senior legal advisor in the 1990s, went on MSNBC last night and said, Michael Cohen doesn't even want a pardon from Donald Trump. He has things to offer the Mueller campaign. We're looking at the New York Times. We're looking at the Washington Post. When we look at the actual things that the two of them were convicted of, one, Michael Cohen is the personal lawyer, was the personal lawyer of Donald Trump for more than a decade. Manafort was briefly the campaign chairman for the Republican for Trump's campaign in the summer of 2016. None, zero of these charges have anything to do with Russia collusion. But when I'm looking at the New York Times, and if the reader is reading it sort of with that in mind, you can't help but come to the conclusion that Mueller and the courts have finally landed the big punch on Trump about Russia collusion. Go ahead.
Well, yes, that was the coverage on MSNBC and elsewhere yesterday. That this is it. This is the impeachment moment. It kind of reminds me, it's quite flimsy, this charge, the Cohen one, because what it's trying, he was charged with is breaking electoral law by giving money, paying money off to a porn star not to talk about it, what happened between she and Trump. So that it would help him, it would not hurt him in his election effort. That was considered a campaign donation above the limit, $150,000. I mean, this is clearly like, to me, like the Clinton's lie that he was impeached for. And it's nothing to do with Russia. But, you know, the New York Times in their editorial, if I could point out, says that the particular issue raised the prospect for Mr. Trump's president could be at risk of impeachment, even if the sprawling Russian investigation never definitively concludes there was collusion or justice. So the Times is admitting this, that maybe it would never happen. There'll never be proof of collusion. But on the other hand, they're calling anyone who questions this supposed link to Russia a fantasist. That's just outrageous because, as you pointed out, Brian, there is, as of yet, still no indictment for collusion. There is no connection between Manafort's indictment, convictions yesterday, which happened all before he joined the Trump campaign and had nothing to do with Russia, and the Cohen conviction because he paid off a porn star not to ruin Trump's chances of being elected. This is beyond belief that they're trying to connect us to Russia, but to be expected.
Dan Kovalik, you're an attorney. I want to read from a legal opinion in the New York Times. The writers say that this is a legal opinion. When a lawyer tells prosecutors that his client directed him to commit a crime and pleads guilty to related crimes himself, an indictment of the client is very likely to follow. The nation is about to find out whether there is an exception to that general rule when the client is the president of the United States. Now, that's talking about the point that Joe just made, that what Michael Cohen is saying is, I paid off Stormy Daniels and another woman not to talk about the affair or alleged affair that they had with Donald Trump. And I did so on the order of Donald Trump. Thus, he committed, he pled guilty to a violation of campaign financing. And he says, I committed this crime, but I was told to do it by Donald Trump. The argument in the New York Times piece is, will the president, Donald Trump, be an exception to the rule? Does that ring true to you?
Well, it does ring true to me. I mean, I think if you tell someone to do something who you have authority over and they do it and it's an unlawful act, you do have some liability for what that person does. In this case, as was mentioned, there could be a violation of campaign finance law. And again, I think Trump may have run afoul of it if he did indeed order Cohen to make this hush payment to Stormy Daniels. And again, this, you know, depending on, I guess, what happens in the midterms, this could possibly lead to some sort of impeachment proceedings. But again, this has nothing to do with the Russia collusion. I mean, this is just so tangential to what we thought the Mueller investigation was supposed to be about. But this may be a problem for Trump nonetheless. I've actually thought all along that it was the Stormy Daniels situation that was going to get him into trouble, and it's looking like it very well might.
Actually, you said that on the show a month or two ago, that if something was going to bring Donald Trump down, it was going to be the Stormy Daniels scandal.
Yes, and I maintain that position.
All right. Jim Kavanaugh, again, let's read the New York Times. I'd like to have an annotated version of the New York Times, because the things that we're saying are such that if Michael Cohen says, I committed a crime, Donald Trump ordered me to commit a crime, okay, then there might be culpability either through an indictment or an impeachment of Donald Trump. But I want to read the New York Times paragraph, because Joe mentioned the fantasist phrase. Here's what they said. Let that sink in. That's today's New York Times editorial entitled All the President's Crooks. Let that sink in. Mr. Trump's own lawyer has now accused him under oath of committing a felony. And then it goes on, and this is the why we need annotation. Only a complete fantasist, that is, only President Trump and his cult, could continue to claim that this investigation, a foreign subversion of an American election, which has already yielded dozens of other indictments and several guilty pleas, is a, quote, hoax, close quote, or a, quote, scam, close quote, or a rigged witch hunt, close quote. I mean, you see the mixing and matching there. Anyway, go ahead, Jim.
Well, yes, clearly there is a possible, as Dan said, felony charge for the campaign contribution thing, but it really has nothing to do with the Russiagate business and the Russia collusion and subversion of an election. It has nothing to do with that. And I think what we have to, I want to say something very clearly here, which I think we have to realize, these convictions would not have happened if Hillary Clinton had been elected president. All of these crimes that took place years before the election, and even, I would say, the campaign contribution crime, would never have been investigated.
True.
Because everything would have been right with the political world, and nobody would have thought it was necessary to go and look for them. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's kind of, you know, if anybody thinks about it, they're going to have to acknowledge that it's probably true. These are the kinds of things that go on, certainly the financial crimes that go on among the financial elite all the time, and even the kind of payoff, some kind of payoff, to shut someone up in an election. You know, if you looked hard enough, you'd find it probably in a lot of campaigns. But, so it's really kind of the opposite. The only reason these crimes have come about was because Donald Trump is president, and they want to get Donald Trump. And they put in place a prosecution which was open-ended, where the special prosecutor, special counsel, was allowed to go after anything he found, even though the ostensible reason was Russian subversion, but he was able to dig everywhere for anything. So it's quite the opposite in some sense. If you kind of acknowledge to yourself that, you know, if Donald Trump hadn't been elected, these things wouldn't have been even investigated. Sure, you'll find them if you investigate for them. But they have been found, but they've been found only because they wanted to go after Donald Trump.
Okay, Joe Lauria. You know, one of the things that sort of jumped out at me, and John and I were talking about this earlier, is that Manafort has been found guilty of 5 counts of tax evasion, 2 counts of bank fraud, 1 count of having a foreign bank account that he didn't report. Then there were 10 other charges that the jury hung on. Now, Rick Gates, who is cooperating with Mueller, knows all the things that Paul Manafort knows, because they were as close as lips and teeth. And in fact, Gates was involved in the same criminal activity that Manafort was, and even additional crimes, because he was actually stealing from Manafort too, hundreds of thousands of dollars, which came out in the Manafort trial. Gates, however, has not gotten any of these serious economic charges. And I want to ask about that. Is Mueller's strategy, and of course this is speculative, Michael Cohen is hoping to cooperate with Mueller, but Mueller is not insisting on cooperation at this point. Maybe he doesn't need Michael Cohen. Maybe Rick Gates is the key, actually, for Mueller trying to bring an indictment of close Trump people like Jared Kushner or Don Trump Jr. Or others. Anyway, what do you make of the role of Gates in all of this?
And remember, there are these unsealed indictments that have already been handed down in the federal district of the District of Columbia. We have no idea yet who those people are.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point, John. We don't know who those people are. To me, Gates is somewhat of a mystery here. He decided to cooperate, didn't he, with Mueller, so that helped get Manafort. But what his punishment will be, what else he can reveal, it's not – I have no idea. The Times says that Cohen could help give information about Trump's dealings in Russia early on. That might be possible. I mean, what we're looking at here, in my opinion, is the – this is about quantity. This Times editorial and that analysis continually talk about dozens of charges or now indictments – or now convictions, a couple of convictions. So they're just piling on. It's a number of crimes that have nothing to do so far with Russia or with Russia collusion. But yet we're going to see more and more of these coming out. And that seems to be enough to just pile them all up. I can't tell you more about Gates. I just don't know what could come from that.
Yeah. Anyway, it's all speculative about Gates. If somebody wants to jump in and speak about that, they obviously need somebody because there's been no practical evidence that's been provided. They need somebody to say the things that Mueller needs them to say on Russia, because so far, all as we're talking about, all of these indictments don't have anything to do with Russia. And Manafort's role in Ukraine, working with Yanukovych and the Party of Regions, was trying to move Yanukovych into the camp of the West, into the camp of the United States and the EU. It wasn't looked upon in a friendly way by the Kremlin, certainly. I want to come back to Dan Kovalik, but first let's hear the voice of Robert Kuzami. He's the deputy U.S. attorney after Michael Cohen's plea deal yesterday. Again, talking about what Michael Cohen actually did plead guilty to. Let's listen.
In addition, Mr. Cohen pled guilty to two campaign finance charges, one for causing an unlawful corporate contribution, and a second one for personally making an excessive personal contribution, both for the purpose of influencing the 2016 election. In addition, what he did was he worked to pay money to silence two women who had information that he believed would be detrimental to the 2016 campaign and to the candidate and the campaign. In addition, Mr. Cohen sought reimbursement for that money by submitting invoices to the candidate's company, which were untrue and false.
Okay, Dan, again, I mean, the public, when they hear these things, they say, so it happened. Michael Cohen, Trump's personal lawyer, he's finally pled guilty. It's all true. But when you actually hear the voice of the deputy U.S. attorney surrounded by other U.S. attorneys explaining what Cohen did and what he pled to, it is absolutely not about Russia.
Right. Unless Stormy Daniels is a Russian spy, and which I don't think she is, this has nothing to do with Russia. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a classic case of people trying to silence people who have dirty information on them. In this case, an affair affairs, because now he's saying at least two women or more that Trump had affairs with, and it was done in the context of the campaign. And as you heard, there's a number of ways in which that might have been illegal, those payments. But again, this has nothing to do with the so-called Russiagate scandal. I mean, and that frankly, Mueller has anything to do with it is kind of amazing.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to another audio clip, because again, even though it's not about Russia collusion at this point, maybe that's where Mueller will end up. Maybe. We'll see. I want to play an audio clip from Senator Richard Blumenthal talking on CNN about the fallout of the conviction and the plea deal and also their own hearings on Russia. Let's listen to that, and then I want to get your opinion from a historical point of view.
Well, if we're in a Watergate moment where the two parties have to come together, we need bipartisanship now more than ever to protect the special counsel and to stop, and I must underscore, stop any consideration of pardons, which undoubtedly will be another.
The president has the right to pardon Paul Manafort, for example, if he wanted to.
He has the power to pardon Paul Manafort, but he would be screaming to the world, I am guilty. And he would so undermine the credibility of his office that it would be a disaster for the nation. And it would very possibly be an obstruction of justice because he would be misusing that power to protect himself as a target of that investigation.
All right, Jim Kavanaugh, your response to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's Watergate moment. You know, it's an impeachment moment. As someone said before, I think, Joe, you know, this is like what happened to Bill Clinton. You know, is Trump's campaign contribution felony any worse than Bill Clinton's perjury? Is this really going to be a grounds for impeachment? Is that what they're really going for here? The Democrats now, by making these events and these pleas and convictions into this case, Watergate moment, they're putting themselves in a spot because their base, which they've riled up against Trump for a year and a half, 2 years, is going to demand that they go for impeachment now. They're saying it. And I don't think the Democrats really want to do that. I don't think they really think they can succeed in it in the Senate. And I think doing it is going to create such a mess politically that, you know, the people who are Trump supporters are going to say, you're just doing what the Republicans did to Bill Clinton. He committed a crime, too. So, you know, and they're going to be right. And this is just a covering, you know, trying to overturn the political results of the election. And it's also, you know, if you're going to start bringing charges against everybody who's been a parasite on the political process, the whole political culture is run by consultants who make millions of dollars like Manafort did and hide money in bank accounts, you know, you're going to go after a lot of people. So there's a whole thing here that the Democrats have opened up for themselves. Are they really going to go after impeachment now? And how are they going to stop their base from demanding that they do? So, you know, we have the example of Bill Clinton's impeachment. It didn't help the Republicans. I don't think it's going to help the Democrats.
Yeah, I think you're right. If all the lobbyists were who were involved in tax evasion, bank fraud, or lying were actually put in prison, we'd have another new phase of the system of mass incarceration. You know, I'd like to talk, you know, Joe Lurie, when you look at the New York Times editorial, all the president's crooks, one of them, Mr. Trump's own lawyer, has now implicated him in a crime. The rhetoric is interesting to me, and I want to ask you about it because, you know, what Jim just said, the Trump base is going to feel this is political. The Democrats will have their own reaction. But when the New York Times editorial say, only a complete fantasist, that is, only President Trump and his cult could continue to claim that this investigation of foreign subversion of an American election is a hoax. I mean, the Trump cult, that's a swath of the American people at this point. And again, we're not Trump supporters here, just the opposite. But it's kind of unusual language to talk about a candidate who has 90% support in the Republican Party and probably 40% approval ratings in the country to talk about his supporters who think this is a witch hunt and think it's a hoax, that they're a cult. I mean, I think it's extraordinary language. What do you think?
Well, it is. I'm not a member of it, of that cult. I'm not in his base. And I think it's politicized. It's clearly politicized. I totally agree with the previous comments. This is totally politicized. And I think the Clinton analogy has to be stressed over and over again because he lied about something. It has to do with sex as well, both of these, interestingly enough. And it was small potatoes. It is small potatoes given the grandiose charges that have been made against Trump. But that doesn't seem to matter to the editorial writers at the New York Times. They are using extraordinary language here, and including what we just pointed out about anybody who thinks this is not a huge deal and is not connected to Russia is somehow a fantasist. Well, the New York Times is so driven, as the rest of the Democratic media is, to want to have Michael Pence be our president? And I really don't understand that, I have to say. I think he would be far worse than Trump for a number of reasons. I think you're going to go from a guy paying off hookers to another guy who wouldn't even dine with someone who's not a woman who's not his wife. And I think that, unfortunately, Pence is more organized and has great ties inside Congress. He could drive through an extremist GOP agenda a lot better than the chaotic Trump could. We should think about this, whether we really want Mike Pence to be president. But the Times is going for blood here, and they're just piling on dozens of indictments, dozens of charges, you know, none of it having real good quality to it. These aren't serious matters, except Manafort's crimes. As was pointed out, if you start digging in that direction, you're going to find a whole bunch of people who are doing this. That's the way our system and political culture works. But what does this have to do with Russia again? Nothing. But it doesn't matter. They want to get him. I think maybe the intelligence and people want to connect us to Russia more. I think Democrats just want to get Trump. But there is a whole group in the intelligence community who want this to tarnish Russia as well.
Somebody else was trying to jump in. Who was that? Was that Jim?
Yeah, I was going to say something about your point about Pence was really on target, because I think the whole impeachment thing, if you start thinking about it, has no place to go that's good. If the Democrats lose it, then they just look like fools. If they win it, the Trump base, which, as you say, is a large swath of the population, is going to say, well, they just overturned the election on us. Rightfully so. They're going to say that. They did what the Republicans tried to do to Clinton but couldn't. And if they win it, if they get rid of Trump, they force him to resign or impeach him and convict him, then the real Democratic base that's been riled up against Trump is going to turn around and find themselves with a Pence presidency. And they're going to be saying, what the hell is this all about? You know, why are we in this game if this is all we're going to get from it? So you're going to have a lot more people on both sides threatened with just withdrawing from the system, of the electoral system entirely, because you're demonstrating that the two-party system doesn't give you very good choices either way. And so one of the reasons I think that Democrats are reluctant to do this, because any way you play this, it's going to be very divisive. It's going to be the thing that disrupts the system much more than Facebook ads from, you know, Russian troll farms. This whole process would disrupt the system in a very powerful way. Even if they win, they're going to start losing. The result of it, as you said, Joe, the Pence presidency is going to say to the Democrats who were riled up for this, why did we get involved in this if this is going to be the end of it?
Yeah, Dan Kovalik, we have about 2.5 minutes left. Earlier today, Sarah Huckabee Sanders told the press in the White House press room, quote, "I don't think the president is concerned at all. He knows that he did nothing wrong and that there was no collusion. And we're going to continue focusing on things that Americans care about and that we can have an impact on." Now, that's obviously a political orientation towards his political base, towards the 90% of the Republican Party that supports Donald Trump. When you think about the comparison, because Richard Blumenthal is saying it's a Watergate moment, we have the Republicans and Democrats have to come together as they did to get rid of Nixon, forcing him to resign rather than be impeached. I think this is far, far different, because Richard Nixon did not have a militantly organized base. He did not enjoy 90% support of the Republican Party. There wasn't this kind of atmosphere where people felt, oh, Nixon has just been attacked from day one, that he's the target of a political campaign. It seems so far different for me. And I don't see how, if Mueller and the others go for a legal solution, meaning indicting all of the Trump people, in this kind of context, I think the country will interpret it, a big part of it, as purely political and react accordingly. In other words, we could be in a very, very new situation. Take us out. We have 1 minute left.
Yes. Well, there's a lot to unpack there. But in short, I think what Huckabee Sanders said, you know, is also conflate some things. I think that it is true that there is no evidence of collusion here, and I don't think we're ever going to see any, by the way. But I don't believe that Trump is unworried about this, again, because I do think the Stormy Daniels payment issue could very much come back to haunt him. But in the end, I think that those who are hoping that the Russia collusion issue is going to trip up Trump will be very disappointed. But I also agree with everyone today who said that, you know, we should not wish Mike Pence on the world. He could actually, I think, be reelected. And I think Trump at this point would have a hard time doing so. So
be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, those are extremely important points. And actually, the only thing that Donald Trump, from a progressive point of view, has done that is good would be the attempt to have normalized relations with North Korea. And you know that Mike Pence would be more than happy, like John Bolton, to completely sabotage that. So I think the Democratic liberal progressive base has actually stopped thinking about the big picture. And bottom line, no matter how this ends, we're going to be in a new Cold War with not just Russia. It's morphing into a Cold War with China, with Iran. And these Cold Wars are not so cold sometimes. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. His most recent piece is Fighting Fake Stories, The New Yorker, Israel, and Obama. We were joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Plot to Attack Iran. And we were joined from Virginia by Joe Loria. He is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he is the author of the book, How I Lost, by Hillary Clinton. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States, with Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can find out about their work and his writings at beyondnuclear.org. This week, we're joined from Michigan. Kevin Camps is in Michigan, in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And we're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Nicole, Kevin Camps, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Well, anyway, Kevin, we normally talk about all things nuclear, but that's because of the grave dangers that nuclear energy gives society and the grave dangers posed by nuclear weapons. But nuclear power is just one energy source. There are others. There's oil and natural gas and solar and wind and, of course, coal. And with that said, we have some things to talk about regarding coal. Donald Trump, who has campaigned vigorously for the restoration of the coal industry and the relaxation or elimination or, I don't know, extinguishing of regulations that try to provide cleaner air for people. He was in West Virginia yesterday making his case again for the, I don't know, the obliteration of any standards established by President Obama to make the air a little bit cleaner when it comes to coal. I want to play an audio clip before we begin and then have you react to it. This is Donald Trump telling his adoring fans in West Virginia why he believes coal is so, so great. Let's listen.
In times of war, in times of conflict, you can blow up those windmills. They fall down real quick. You can blow up those pipelines. They go like this, and you're not going to fix them too fast. You can do a lot of things to those solar panels, but you know what you can't hurt? Coal. You can do whatever you want to coal.
That was, you can do anything you want to coal. I mean, does that mean that Donald Trump believes that the pipelines in America are a threat to national security? Because he seems intent on building pipelines, too. Anyway, Kevin, what do you think?
Well, you know, it's theater of the absurd on steroids. I mean, actually, solar and wind are less vulnerable to even an explosive terrorist attack than would be highly centralized facilities like a coal burner, for example, or a nuclear power plant, which, you know, as Fukushima and Chernobyl have shown, if you were to blow up a nuclear plant intentionally, that would have wide-ranging radiological consequences like uninhabitability of an entire, you know, time zone. But wind and solar, you'd have to go way out of your way to blow up all those individual wind turbines. You know, it doesn't even take an explosive attack. There are cyber attack scenarios that could take down the grid. So, yeah, we have to address these vulnerabilities, and one of the best ways to do that is to decentralize, which means wind and solar and microgrids, and Trump's just got it completely upside down. Surprise, surprise.
Nicole, did you feel that there was a demagogic element to Donald Trump's speech in West Virginia?
No way. Absolutely not.
No, it was just, it's what he believes.
That might be right, yeah. I mean, if you blow up a coal mine or a coal burner, that seems bad. I think that would cause some pretty bad explosions.
On the basis of what Trump's argument is, and okay, it is a demagogic argument, but based on this argument in West Virginia, every nuclear facility in the country should actually be shut down, no?
Yes.
Well, you know, one way I look at these things is like, you know, 350.org, Bill McKibben has pointed out, we have to stop combusting fossil fuels. The atmosphere can't take it anymore. We're unleashing a climate catastrophe upon our planet, and our life support systems are dismantling before our eyes in daily headlines now. And so we have to stop that. And the burning of fossil fuels as time goes forward is in itself a slow motion terrorist attack, is a way to look at it. We are inflicting unspeakable harm onto present and future generations. So there's that way of looking at things. And another way of looking at things is, like you said, if you blow up a coal plant, yeah, there are consequences. The workers on site are probably going to be killed. There's going to be a large release of carbon pollution from the attack, but there was going to be anyway, just through routine operations. With a nuclear plant, though, if you unleash the radioactive core into the environment or the spent fuel pool is on fire, that's a Fukushima caused intentionally. So why would you not try to prevent such catastrophic scenarios by developing renewable energy, which is a lot more protected against such a terrorist attack and doesn't release carbon pollution into the atmosphere? So that's just, you know, we're through the looking glass, of course, with the Trump administration.
Relatedly, Kevin, there's a couple of updates that I would love to hear from you on, an update on FERC's role in the, or lack thereof, in the first energy bailout scheme, bailing out coal burners, bailing out old atomic reactors, as well as some updates on Fukushima. Do you want to update us on those two topics?
I wanted to stay with a little bit more on the coal question, because here's another, but those are important stories. Don't get me wrong. but before we get to those stories, I want to, you know, here's the thing. People don't actually want to work in coal mines. People want to work in coal mines because there's no other work that pays a decent wage in West Virginia. When you think about what Trump is doing, I mean, and what the politicians are doing, they're counterposing the issue of jobs and people coming out of poverty, which is a key not only to employment, it's a key to whether your kids can go to a doctor when they're sick. It means, you know, you have access to medicine. You have so much, you take the opioid crisis in West Virginia. Why is that happening? Coal mines were shutting down. Miners were also getting sick and hurt on the job a lot. In other words, having a lot of pain and needing medication for that. You know, the government of the United States has an absolute, I would say, obligation, if we're going to convert from coal or from nuclear or from whatever energy source, including oil and gas, to other ones, to make sure it's not at the expense of the people who are doing that kind of backbreaking labor. And it could be, this is not some utopian scheme. I mean, when you think that the U.S. government spent, as you know, we learned a couple of weeks ago, $10 trillion on developing nuclear weapons since 1942 or 43, certainly you could have that kind of bailout program so that the conversion to safe, clean, green energy sources isn't at the expense of already poor communities like those communities in West Virginia that are being demagogically appealed to by Donald Trump. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, well, you know, if you approach things from a fact-based rationality, we've got some choices to make between dirty, dangerous, and expensive energy technologies like coal and nuclear and other fossil fuels, and the promise of a clean energy future, genuinely clean, from renewables and efficiency. And some countries in the world get that now, like Germany, the fourth largest economy on the planet, which is phasing out nuclear, 4 years from now, and phasing out fossil fuel burning, or at least cleaning it up to the point by mid-century where you have 85% reductions over 2005 or maybe it was 1995 levels of greenhouse gas emissions. Or you have the Trump approach, which is more of the same. It's kind of not even a 1950s outlook. It's more like a 1870s outlook where, you know, coal's where it's at and that's the future. So you're absolutely right. We've got some choices to make. And if we choose the coal and the nuclear, and that gets back to Nicole's question about the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they've been asked by the likes of First Energy Nuclear Operating Company in Ohio and Pennsylvania, which is also a coal-burning company, to bail them out to the tune of, if this were applied from coast to coast, it would be a $34 billion a year bailout paid for by the public to prop up these dirty, dangerous, and expensive technologies of the past. Or think of what we could do with that kind of money if we invested it in the energy of the future, which is renewables and efficiency. And if we choose not to do that, there will be no future because we're going to have a climate catastrophe and the planet will become less and less habitable. So the choices are pretty clear, actually. But then there's Trump.
Yeah. And again, you know, Hillary Clinton made that big gaffe when she went to West Virginia, was faced with an angry crowd. And she basically said, yeah, if we convert from coal, a lot of you are going to lose your jobs or something like that. I'm going to look for the quote right now. She tried to explain and put it into context later, but a huge political blunder, a political gaffe. And that's what's wrong about the debate. The debate is like people who care about environment are suggesting that that's primary, and thus we don't have to really care about the fact that obsolete or dangerous or dirty industries have to go. They kind of make this juxtaposition that allows demagogues like Donald Trump to take advantage of that and act as if Donald Trump is the friend of the coal miner, the friend of the worker, the friend of impoverished communities in West Virginia. That's the problem. And that's why I think we have to have an approach, an environmental approach, the one that Kevin is suggesting, making it clear that these are not impossible things. These are political choices and policy choices. And it could even be done within the framework of the existing political and economic order. It doesn't really, as we can see in Germany, require a social revolution to make rational policy choices. I mean, there might be a reason for social revolution in general. I'm not against that. But my point is, these are policy choices that could be adopted. That's what you're saying, Kevin. I mean, this is within grasp.
And a lot of environmental groups have long gotten that, too, and labor. So you have, like, the Blue-Green Alliance, Sierra Club, and the steelworkers, and many others who have been at it for a long time, many years, more than a decade. And, you know, you see it in the anti-mountaintop removal movement of West Virginia, because that's how they're getting the coal now. They're destroying ecosystems, some of the most biologically diverse ecosystems in North America, Appalachian Mountains, where they take the mountaintop and they dump it in the valley, and they level everything out, and they kill everything, and they sterilize it. So one of my colleagues at Chesapeake Climate Action Network, Mike Tidwell, is a former National Geographic ornithologist who decided he'd better jump into the environmental and climate movement because the birds of Appalachia are being destroyed by mountaintop removal. And, you know, so when he's presented with a challenge about wind turbines killing birds, he points out, you know, you want to talk about killing birds? Let's talk about taking a mountaintop and dumping it into a valley and destroying the bird's habitat entirely. So people get it, and this divide and conquer that Trump, and, you know, another weakness, violation of the worker that the Democrats have engaged in is cozying up to the nuclear power industry. You know, Obama, a lot of his inner circle were Exelon nuclear higher-ups, from David Axelrod to Valerie Jarrett to Rahm Emanuel. And now we're seeing, you know, nuclear workers' jobs being leveraged to secure bailouts at the expense of the public to keep a relatively small number of workers employed at a relatively high paycheck, when that same money could provide the same kind of pay in the renewable industry or in, you know, safeguarding the nuclear waste or cleaning up the radioactive contamination. So, you know, the Democrats have some answering to do, too.
Yeah.
Like you said about Clinton's gaffe.
Yeah. And again, I found it now. It's back in March 2016. Hillary Clinton was at a Democratic town hall in Ohio as part of an answer on energy policy. It's taken out of context, of course, but as part of her answer, she said, quote, "We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business." Now, that might just be bad politicking because she said more. She wasn't actually saying, yeah, let's go put coal miners out of business. But it's the kind of sort of insensitivity to what the debate is, and in particular, to the right-wing demagogy, like the demagogy coming from Donald Trump, that can only be answered with a very, very clear answer, a clear sort of political presentation. And you know, Nicole, what Kevin is saying is now we have these nuclear industry sort of bloated, bankrupt institutions that are dangerous, and they should be shut down. But instead of being shut down, they're asking the government, we the people, meaning our tax dollars, to bail them out. And they always say, they'll never say, that's because we're fabulously rich and we want to stay fabulously rich and we can do it if you bail us out. So no, they're not going to say that because guess what? Nobody's going to buy that one. They're going to say, for the sake of nuclear energy workers and their families, this is what we're fighting for. Again, pure demagogy. And people become victims of deception, which is what this is, or self-deception if they allow themselves to buy into that kind of narrative. That's why having a correct or politically, you know, like an orientation on these issues is so critically important.
And like you're saying, these two things are both connected, right? When we are when Hillary's saying, I'm going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business, and we're seeing the Obama administration with Kevin, as you said, so many executives who worked for Exelon, who worked for you know, other kind of nuclear companies. These are all connected things. These are all workers who need jobs, and we could put these people to work doing any kind of cleaner, better activity. I mean, there's all sorts of infrastructure in this you know, country that needs to be updated, that needs to be supported. We need lots of new clean green energy, and we have a lot of the technology we need to do it. We just need the funding. We need the people who are in charge to be, you know, more interested in doing that rather than putting the money in the nuclear companies' pockets and putting, you know, keeping people working in coal mines, which are dirty, dangerous, and really bad for people's health anyway.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Something that's really telling about, you know, the connections between these companies, they do both coal and nuclear, is First Energy in Ohio and Pennsylvania. One of their big blunders was purchasing Allegheny Energy of West Virginia, a coal-burning company. And it was a major mistake, and it contributed mightily to the bankruptcy of First Energy across that whole region. And what's really telling is here's this bankrupt company begging for a mega bailout from the Trump administration, but taking steps towards shutdown of its atomic reactors and coal plants in a place like Ohio. And this is what's so telling is they went to the bankruptcy judge, the company did, and they said, can you please secure the management salaries and the top executives and even, to some extent, the shareholder returns at the expense of the workers in these facilities? And the unions representing the workers said back to the bankruptcy judge, that's not fair. So guess who gets thrown under the bus when things go badly? The workers that Trump says he cares about, the company is willing to sacrifice in order to prop up the salaries of the executives who made these bad decisions.
Yeah, it's just demagogy. We can't say it enough times, and I've said it 10 times, so I'm going to say it more. This is pure demagogy on Trump and on these executives' part. Let's talk about who Andrew Wheeler is, the new head of the EPA, replacing the disgraced, corrupt, well, I would say corrupt, in my own personal opinion, corrupt Scott Pruitt. Andrew Wheeler, I believe, was a lobbyist for the coal industry. And now, Kevin, the Trump administration, right before he went to West Virginia, announced that the Trump administration will overhaul the climate change regulations that that Obama enacted in order to put some some sort of inhibitions, obstructions on coal pollution in the air and in the environment. Let's talk about both things. What would it mean to have the, quote, relaxation of these regulations, and who is Andrew Wheeler?
Well, you know, President Trump likes to talk about the war on coal. Well, he just declared war on the climate, and I don't think the climate can take much more. And so you've got the acting EPA director, Wheeler, who is a former coal industry lobbyist extraordinaire, and then you've got his bureaucrat lawyer in charge of implementing this clean power plan extermination, get rid of Obama's clean power plan, replace it with this polluting plan. And he's also a fossil fuel industry lawyer who apparently is getting away with this through the revolving door trick that he's doing, because the rules against industry lawyers taking a position in government like this are weaker than the rules against a lobbyist. So it's a, you know, it's a loophole in the law. And these two guys at the head of this policymaking at the EPA, you know, they're doing a huge favor to the industry that has made them rich already. So, you know, this is the fox guarding the hen house on steroids, and we're all going to pay with our health. The figures are something like 1,500 people per year will die if this policy goes forward. The EPA, under these former lobbyists and lawyers from industry, admit that in the fine print. So don't take it from me. Take it from their own documentation.
Andrew Wheeler, who is now heading up the EPA, as you mentioned, Kevin, it was also an aide to Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe, who you know, has a very strong reputation for being the, one of the most vigorous climate deniers on the Hill, who has actually said publicly that educating school children on the basics of climate change was tantamount to brainwashing. And so he also, when Inhofe made some comments when Wheeler was nominated, he said that there's no one more qualified than Andrew to help Scott Pruitt restore the EPA to its proper size and scope, which
would be
given what Pruitt was doing, would be, yeah, would be absolutely nothing.
I mean, and also, you know, it's interesting. This is for our audience to understand. This is part of a bigger package. It's Trump going to West Virginia right before the midterms. There's politics involved. But Obama himself and his administration adopted the Clean Power Plan, as it's called, which is what Trump is undoing now, in order for the United States to conform to international standards required by the Paris Climate Treaty Agreement. So the U.S., to be a signatory to that, had to clean up its own coal-polluting processes. When Trump came in, he immediately said, as one of his first acts, the U.S. would leave this. So we're talking about the microeconomics and micropolitics of what's going on in West Virginia and coal. But this is all part of a plan to smash any sort of international agreement or the U.S. participation in any kind of international agreement that could help stem the tide of global warming. Go ahead, Kevin. Then we're going to go on to another subject.
Well, for American listeners to realize, the United States is the only country on the planet that is not a signatory to the Paris Climate Agreement. And yes, this is just a further step in that direction, but we are the rogues in this case.
Let's go on to some of our other stories. The time is going so fast. We have about 5.5 minutes left. Nicole, you were raising other issues earlier. Let's go back to them.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff going on. Kevin, I think maybe the most interesting, if you wouldn't mind talking us through the First Nations in Canada, it looks like there's a bunch of corruption that's been going on in Canada around nuclear issues, around some defunct nuclear reactors. Do you want to talk us through what's going on?
Yeah, a press release just went out a day or two ago from the Canadian anti-nuclear movement in alliance with First Nations and other environmental groups. And what it has to do with is that in Canada, they've just thrown caution to the wind and any pretense of really caring the industry has. They're proposing to not really clean up radioactive sites, but simply to try to cover it all up and walk away. And these sites, because of cooling needs, are often on the sides of rivers. They're even on the Great Lake shorelines. They're on the seacoasts. it's a pretty bad idea, because what it means is over a long enough period of time, that radioactive contamination is going to go into those surface waters. And if that's the Great Lakes, then you're talking the drinking water for 40 million people in two countries. So, you know, the defenders of the environment are standing up against it. And there's a connection to the United States, not just that we share these waters like on the Great Lakes, but there's a Canadian company out of Montreal called SNC-Lavalin, a major engineering firm that's involved in nuclear matters up there. They're getting involved in U.S. nuclear matters. They have just merged with Holtec International and announced themselves as the preeminent decommissioning company to turn to now in the United States. So that New Mexico dump proposal now kind of involves this scandalously corrupt, actually, Canadian firm that just has a lot of skeletons in its closet, just like Holtec does itself down on this side of the border.
Absolutely. I'm really glad you brought that up this week, Kevin, because I think it's really important to talk about our neighbor. It's it's a country led by Justin Trudeau, who I think a lot of fans of the Democratic Party here in the U.S. look to as, you know, this liberal, this person who, you know, is always going to be in support of things like making sure that drinking water is safe for First Nations and for everyone. But that is very, very clearly not happening. I also was wondering, Kevin, are there any updates about the high-level radioactive trucking route that we heard about just a couple of weeks ago that was up in that same area up from in Illinois and near Port Huron? Is anything going on with that?
Yeah, we just held our fourth annual rally by the river, the St. Clair River in Port Huron, Michigan, which we've been holding for years because we've been fighting this proposed Canadian radioactive waste dump on the Lake Huron shoreline at Bruce Nuclear, the biggest nuclear power plant in the world, which is on native land, the Saugeen Ojibwe Nation. And just prior to holding this event, we found out about a secret shipment of irradiated nuclear fuel from an Illinois nuclear reactor to Chalk River Nuclear Labs in Ontario that would go through Port Huron. So, you know, crazy timing. And the latest is that at the end of this month, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the U.S. will approve the routing, because they always do. They're a rubber stamp. And if the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission approves their end of things, then this shipment by truck through Kalamazoo, Michigan on Interstate 94 could roll. And it's for experimental purposes to test what they call an efficient and safe nuclear fuel. Here we are, 50-plus years into the nuclear industry, and they're still trying to make their fuel efficient and safe. An experiment with no consent from those living near the nuclear plant or along the transport routes involved, or the indigenous people who live next to the nuclear lab in Canada. So you can see what this industry is about. It's about secrecy. It's about non-consensual experimentation with health implications, even if things go well. And so we addressed those concerns in Port Huron just a few days ago.
And Kevin, we only have about 30 seconds left, but I know Nevada has been gearing up for a renewed fight against the Yucca dump. Do you want to briefly let us know what's going on there?
The state of Nevada is ready to rumble, as 1,000 environmental allies have been since 1987, the Screw Nevada Bill. And the same is turning out to be true in New Mexico. There's a groundswell of resistance to the parking lot dump proposed by Holtec out in New Mexico. So it's a gargantuan struggle. And if folks would like to jump in, we could use the help.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined, as we are every Wednesday, by Kevin Camps. Usually Kevin is in studio with us here in Washington, D.C. Today he's in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to their website, beyondnuclear.org, to read about his work and the work of their organization. And most importantly, to get involved in this important issue with Beyond Nuclear. And we've also been joined in studio by Sputnik news analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.